This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, August 11th, 2015.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And oil is not the best lubricant for a nuclear deal. What am I talking about? Well, buying unsanctioned Iranian oil in return for a deal to reduce Iran's nuclear program is perhaps not the real story of that nuclear agreement the Obama administration is working hard to sell to Congress right now. It turns out water may have secretly greased the skids here. Water, the new geostrategic substance. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Also, we will look at how trying to act like water, healthy, essential water, has led the soft drink industry into a marketing dead end that it's trying to get out of with some dubious science. There's no problem with the supply of television shows, though, and America, you might say, is the unrivaled motherlode producer of TV shows. But we may have pumped our peak of scripted dramas, reality shows, comedies, and Amy Schumer videos this year. We'll talk about that in just a moment. It's a very serious business story. But we begin with Iran. It appears that one of the reasons Iran seems less than completely concerned about its nuclear program is that Iran has been having a water crisis for over 16 years. That's its top priority. 2 years ago, a study by the World Resources Institute ranked Iran as the world's 24th most water-stressed nation. Its population has doubled over the last 40 years. Increased water usage combined with the ongoing drought has led Iranian scientists to quietly, back in 2009, ask the United States for help in finding ways to better manage their water resources. The Obama administration was just 4 months old when the ask came from Tehran. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Iran asked if the U.S. would help with the water problem, and the Obama administration quietly said yes. Secretary of State John Kerry is in New York today to try to sell the Iran deal to newsmakers and others, but it will be water that has provided a lot of the momentum of Iran's interest in this nuclear deal. Are there other opportunities for the U.S. to be a water player in international crises and politics? Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit research institute focusing on issues of development, environment, and security. Peter Glick, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Thanks for having me on today.
So is water a geostrategic substance right now, way beyond what oil was, say, in the 20th century?
Well, I think so. I think it always has been in many ways. There are substitutes for oil. We can find other ways to produce the energy we want, but there are no substitutes for water. And as water becomes increasingly scarce, it becomes increasingly problematic in regions around the world, political at times. And at times, unfortunately, there's a long history of conflict, violent conflict sometimes, over water, especially in the Middle East, but even in places we don't think about.
Does it surprise you that water was such a quiet and seemingly more even urgent component of the nuclear deal way back in 2009 than we realized?
No, not at all. I was actually involved in some of the early exchanges with Iranian hydrologists and water experts. In fact, the conversation with Iran and the United States over water has extended back more than a decade, before 2009. There have always been contacts at the university level, at the level of the National Academy of Sciences of the two countries about water efficiency, water conservation, water technologies, how to manage droughts. And as the water situation in the Middle East has gotten worse, the interest has gotten much higher. And there's been a number of conversations back and forth in the United States, in Tunis, in Iran, in France, between U.S. and Iranian scientists about how to manage water resources more effectively.
And one of the ironies I noted this week is that while negotiators were in Vienna, John Kerry was in Vienna, all the nations were in Vienna with the Iranian officials involved in this cliffhanger on the nuclear deal. At the very same time, there were U.S. and Iranian negotiators talking about water in a sense that was not urgent. As you say, it's been going on for a decade, and talks that were not threatened by any sort of cliffhanger or last-minute, speech before a joint session of Congress. Water, it seems, is a much more secure basis for geopolitical cooperation.
Well, that's the hope. You know, scientists talk to scientists. What the politicians do is always a difficult conversation. And the Iranian nuclear deal is a difficult conversation. But it's a little less difficult about things like water, where there's a joint interest in producing food and producing the goods and services we want and protecting ecosystems. And there's information that can be shared and I would argue should be shared. You know, I would note that at the height of the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union had scientists meeting regularly through an organization called Pugwash to talk about nuclear security, to talk about risks to the environment, to keep lines of communication open, even at the worst parts of the Cold War. And some of those conversations led to, for example, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. So these scientist-to-scientists communications can often be really effective when even the politicians don't agree.
So finally, then, is the U.S. a player in water security around the world? Do we have a supplier? Do we have our own scarcity issues that are going to complicate questions of politics in North America in this century?
Well, of course, we're having a horrible drought now in the western United States and California. It's not as though the deal is going to be sharing water. What's really going on is sharing information, sharing ideas, looking for ways to manage our limited water resources more sustainably. And ultimately, that reduces the risk of conflict in the Middle East and everywhere else.
And is the U.S. a leader on this?
Absolutely. I think the technology, the management strategies, the institutions we have, the lessons that we've learned, I think they're applicable here in the United States and in other places around the world.
Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute based in Oakland, California. Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Scarce water in the West has made a cleanup operation in some old mines dangerous. Last week, a chemical spill into the Animas River in southwestern Colorado dumped more than 3 million gallons of mine waste into the river and turned it colors not found in nature. Sean McGrath, Administrator for Region 8 of the EPA, says the agency is working to contain the damage.
It continues to discharge, and it's at the volume of about 500 gallons per minute. That discharge is going into a settlement pond, two settlement ponds that we created over the last couple of days.
Officials in towns downstream of the spill are concerned, along with the Navajo Nation, which covers part of New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. The EPA, the agency responsible for the cleanup, says it was also responsible for the spill. Senator Ellen Roberts is a Republican state senator representing Durango, Colorado, in the damage zone, and she says it's her community's front yard.
What we've lost is confidence, I guess, in the EPA, and that's a big struggle for us. The Animas River to Durango is our lifeblood, and it's where we recreate, but it's where we get our water, and every drop of water matters, so we're very concerned.
Can you tell me what the river looks like and what the contamination is?
Well, the river these days is running much clearer. We had a couple of days where it was running orange, and then it turned more of a yellow and then a pea green. But they call it a slug. The toxic waste slug moved through Durango and actually now is making its way through the Navajo Nation.
And the fact that the EPA has claimed responsibility for this, I mean, what does that say to you about our ability to control the environment or to make the environment safe?
We were all pretty startled, and it came from the EPA was in our area because they were trying to remediate old mine waste, and I don't think anybody faults them for that. The issue was how they went about trying to deal with the toxic waste that was up there, and from the moment that they kind of unleashed it into the river to failure to notify communities down the river throughout, including to the Navajo Nation, I think has been really concerning. The role they usually play is one of a regulatory agency, and now it's the roles are reversed, and it's not going so well.
The water has had a competing demand from people in your part of the world. It's been used for all kinds of things, and drinking water is just one of them. Can you sketch out a little bit of the tensions between water use among ranchers and miners and farmers and the regular residents?
Well, there hasn't been active mining in that particular mine for a long time. So again, it kind of goes back to the late 1800s that the mine waste comes from. But you're right, the Animas River flows from Silverton, makes its way through the southwest corner of Colorado, goes into New Mexico, and then through the Navajo Nation. So there are competing interests all along the river. We have farmers and ranchers. We have towns like Durango and Silverton. So it's drinking water. It's where we recreate. It's an incredibly important resource because water is scarce in our corner of the world.
In a time of drought, do you worry that the aquifers, if they do return in your part of the world, will contain a lot of the chemicals that will be leached out of the old mines? And, you know, you've created history of Colorado and the West has created a kind of sponge of all kinds of chemicals that heavy rains and snows and runoff is going to be leaching for decades to come.
Well, the EPA has told us that they expect that every spring runoff and every big storm event has the potential to stir up what has been dropped in the river as that toxic slug made its way through. But we also expect that there will be cleanup efforts by the EPA since this was done at their hands. So they have committed to doing that. And again, we plan to hold them accountable to that.
It's a question of trust. Do you have enough?
Well, trust is a little scarce right now. And the problem is that we just don't get the information. This happened last Wednesday, and we still don't know what's in the water. And I appreciate that the EPA wants to have some extensive testing done before they give us the answer. But we have rafting companies that no longer can put their customers in the water. Our fishermen can't do that. Our drinking water for Durango has been shut down off that river. They have an alternate supply, but they need the animus as well. And so for us, every day that goes by that we don't have those answers about what's in the water from the EPA, then frustration grows very high, and that does undermine the trust.
Senator Ellen Roberts is a Republican state senator representing Durango, Colorado. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thank you.
In December of 1972, the crew of the Apollo 17 mission nabbed the planetary tourist picture of all time, called the Blue Marble Earth. It's Earth from a distance as a perfect, fully illuminated sphere. If you close your eyes, you can probably see that image. It's one of the most widely distributed images in history. Since then, there hasn't been a spacecraft far enough away from home to take another whole Earth selfie. There have been composite images assembled by NASA, but just last month, the NASA Discover satellite was able to capture another whole Earth picture for the first time since 1972. Dr. Mae Jemison is a former astronaut on the Endeavour shuttle and a current principal of the 100-year Starship Project. Dr. Jemison says the image Discover has given us is way beyond what she experienced in the space shuttle.
In the shuttle, we actually are bound for anywhere from 250 to 300 miles above the Earth's surface. And what you're actually looking at is you see this hemisphere. And what strikes me about it is that the Earth almost seems to iridesce from within. It just glows, and there's this incredible glistening land and water. And it makes you know that you're connected to the rest of the universe. At least that's what it did for me.
There's something about that blue marble picture that's both living and familiar and also very vulnerable. Do you think NASA Discover has captured that once again?
Well, you know, for me, I never see it as vulnerable. I actually see it as very empowering because, again, it seems that connection is there. I think the NASA Discover picture shows us that we're even more a part of this universe because it shows our moon-Earth system. There are not a lot of rest stops between here and the next planet or the next star. And, of course, the next galaxy is something we don't even think about right now going to, even though I'm working on 100-year Starship. We're just trying to figure out how we can get tens of light years away.
And we're also trying to figure out how to get ourselves together here on this planet. What do you think the principal contribution of this image is to help us all feel more together?
Well, I hope what these images show are that we actually have a home that we share. It's a home that we can't separate out. And as you said, any possible other home is very, very far away. So we actually have to figure out how to be Earthlings. That is that we know we have a common origin and a common destiny, and how do we make it the best?
Since we spoke last, there have been a couple of movie representations of what interstellar travel might be like. How do they stack up to the work that you're doing, and what's next for the 100-year Starship?
Well, 100-year Starship is about making sure we have the capabilities to get humans to another star system within the next 100 years. And what I'm always struck by with the movies about interstellar space, they always have these incredible miracle happens here moments constantly, whether it's, you know, a wormhole appears somewhere or there's warp drive. What we need to do right now is just to get to relativistic speeds. We just need to learn how to do sustainable ecosystems and ecologies. All of those things make a really big difference to life here on Earth. And what we're interested in is the impact of the technology to actually find definitively another planet that could sustain our life, because it would change the game in so many ways. It's a technological game changer, and I think it's a philosophical game changer.
On the awe factor, has NASA Discover upgraded the Blue Marble picture with its picture of the Earth system?
Well, I think that awe factor is pretty good on Discover. You know, nowadays we're getting more and more pictures like this. They're pictures that show the Earth and the Moon from the surface of Mars. So we're part of a much bigger universe. And I think as we learn that, we'll start to appreciate one another more.
Astronaut Dr. Mae Jemison is a former astronaut from the Endeavour shuttle mission, the current principal of the 100-year Starship project. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To see the blue marble photos from 1972 and from the NASA Discover today, just visit thetakeaway.org. One of the more striking revelations in the 2014 U.S. Senate's report on the use of torture by the CIA was that two psychologists, James Elmer Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, both former members of the military, were consultants on CIA interrogations. For their role in this grim chapter of American history, the two reportedly received $81 million in contractor fees. At this year's annual convention of the American Psychological Association in Toronto, the association's board voted to bar its members from participating in U.S. national security interrogations involving the use of torture of detainees. Joining me now with more is Nadine Caslow, professor of psychiatry at Emory University and past president of the American Psychological Association. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me to speak with you about this important matter.
Now, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I just have to ask you right off the top. Do you know if James Elmer Mitchell and Bruce Jessen are members of the American Psychological Association?
I know that Dr. Jensen was never a member of the American Psychological Association. I know that Dr. Mitchell used to be a member of the American Psychological Association, and I believe his membership ended in around 2006.
What's to prevent people who aren't in your organization from going after those, you know, CIA dollars, $81 million in some future conflict?
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that the report done by Mr. Hoffman did not find collusion between the APA, the American Psychological Association, and the CIA. Actually, the findings in the report were more focused on the collusion between the APA and the Department of Defense.
And when you say collusion, the American Psychological Association, in theory, would be asked to provide some sort of seal of approval to interrogation techniques that, in fact, you would find reprehensible.
Well, certainly they're reprehensible. I think the point is that it was a small number of officials that were involved in this, and that the evidence is that the purpose of the collusion was not in any way to approve torture, but rather to curry favor with the Department of Defense. And that may have, at some level, enabled involvement in enhanced interrogation or abusive interrogation techniques.
I want to ask you the question I posed just a moment ago one more time, just to make sure that you're clear on it. Given the experience of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and what these two allegedly made off with in terms of federal taxpayer dollars, $81 million in contractor fees, have we entered an era where everybody knows in the APA that they can revoke their membership or resign their membership in the Psychological Association and go off and try to compete for these dollars if the federal government wants a psychologist to be a part of this torture technique?
Well, actually, the policy that we overwhelmingly passed last week was to prohibit all psychologists from participating in national security interrogations involving military and intelligence authorities so that it would apply to everyone.
Mm. Is this, and before we go, final question, is this a distortion of a relationship that psychologists have had traditionally with the Defense Department that has brought the APA to this moment where you really have to break?
No, I think there are many positive elements of our relationship with the Defense Department. There are many military psychologists that do very important things. I think what this was a small group of people potentially involved or involved with something that was just horrific and wrong and that takes us away from our values on human rights.
Are you confident that you still have influence on the federal government to make sure that they don't repeat mistakes of the past?
I am confident that we're going to do our best to try to ensure that. We are absolutely going to urge the government to withdraw its understandings and reservations to the UN Convention Against Torture, in keeping with the recent recommendation of the UN Committee Against Torture.
Nadine Kaslow, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Nadine Kaslow is a professor of psychiatry at Emory University and past president of the American Psychological Association.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
Once upon a time, Coke executives would say their only competition was water and that Coke itself was like life.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey bees and snow white turtle doves.
This classic 1970s ad cost about $250,000 to make. It was made back in the day when drinking Coke was about everything except drinking Coke. With growth unlimited and demand strong, soft drinks were about the aspirations of youth, wealth, style. Turtlenecks were in style back then. Just look at the video. Health, I guess, was one of the aspirations, and world peace or something. Since we were just talking about perhaps having reached the peak of TV production, soft drinks passed that point quite a while ago. For the 10th straight year, U.S. soda consumption is down. Americans drank nearly 1.5 billion fewer cases last year than in 2004, when soda sales hit their all-time high. Among the reasons, youth looks to Red Bull, Gatorade, and other brands these days. Wealth apparently picks Kraft soda drinks or Jennifer Aniston's high-end water and other specialty beverages that have also grabbed the old Coke style as well. And health today shuns sugary drinks for vitamin waters and juices and diet drinks. Coke has to get some of this back, and part of their strategy seems to have been to fight the argument that sugary drinks contribute to obesity. A Coke-funded nonprofit called the Global Energy Balance Network is making the argument that Americans should worry less about what and how much they eat and drink. Instead, it claims the answer is exercise. Yoni Friedhoff is director of the Bariatric Medical Institute in Ottawa, Canada, and author of The Diet Fix. Friedhoff noticed this argument and the new nonprofit group and asked a question. Yoni, what was your question?
I wanted to know who was funding this group. It seemed very strange to me that there were a group of scientists saying that energy balance was plausible in the sense that we can't outrun our forks as much as we would like to believe that we can. It just doesn't work that way.
And so the assumption or the research that they were presenting was a little implausible. And so you looked at the funding source and what did you discover?
Well, so I reached out immediately when I saw the name of the network and I asked, who's funding you? And the answer I got back a few days later was Coca-Cola.
And this isn't unprecedented. The drink industry has spent a lot of time, everything from the dairy industry to Gatorade and other groups have tried to use scientists to make a point that their drink has some benefit that it may or may not have, right?
Yeah, I mean, so it's not surprising that Coca-Cola wants to fund nonprofits that suggest that it doesn't matter what you eat so long as you exercise. That message is a very powerful one in Coke's favor. So go figure that they're getting themselves involved. It's less clear on why the scientists are getting involved and, you know, why this network is necessary, given that we know exercise is an incredibly healthful and beneficial thing to do. It is the world's best drug. But we also know it's not a weight loss drug, and suggesting that it is doesn't, to me, sound like something that will further public health.
Do you think Coke and the soft drink industry in general is kind of desperate, because long past are the days when they thought of themselves as a replacement for water. People have a lot of alternatives. They're looking at what they drink in a very different way. And Coke's got to do something besides, you know, offer a Coke to the world and bring world peace.
Yeah, there's no question they're on the ropes. I mean, if you look at, you know, diet as a whole, society's a bit more concerned now about what we're putting in our bodies. But of all of the things we're putting in our bodies, perhaps none is so clearly not necessary and probably not good for you than sugar-sweetened beverages. So Coca-Cola's flagship drink, well, that is something that is now a target for legislators, for public health crusaders, and for just the general public to say, you know what, this is the one thing I know I can cut out that will probably benefit my health if I do.
What about energy drinks? What about the Gatorade claim that, you know, you need to restore dehydration to get rid of cramps, which reduce your performance in the Olympics?
It's primarily marketing nonsense. You know, so the beverage industry is making an awful lot of money selling sugar water. Sugar water is a very inexpensive product to make, and they can sell it with incredibly high profit margins. This is why there is so much marketing around these beverages. But ultimately, when it comes to the science of exercise, for instance, and electrolyte replacement or refueling or recovering, really that is all marketing, except for a very small percentage of people who are truly elite athletes doing very long endurance style exercise. Everybody else, we should drink when we're thirsty. And that's the secret to staying hydrated.
So the irony here is that if you're going to act as though, you know, Coke and soft drinks are an improvement on water in some way, and try to get scientists to make that argument, you're really barking up the wrong tree. What you might as well do is just, you know, put Jennifer Aniston on a poster and have her holding a glass of water. That actually is more scientifically valid, even if it's the same sort of marketing kind of hocus pocus.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, we live in a world where we've given marketers really, they can do whatever they want. You know, it's like they're unruly teenagers without parents who care what they're doing. And we have allowed this sort of marketing. We have allowed this engagement. You know, Coca-Cola actually isn't doing anything wrong by getting involved with scientists. And I'm not even suggesting necessarily the scientists are doing anything wrong. Many of these scientists have held these beliefs for a long time. But funding this, you know, nonprofit to promote a message of balancing the crappy foods you eat with a little bit of exercise, well, that's in Coke's best interest. It's not in yours or my best interest. And Coca-Cola has gone beyond just scientists. They've also created this organization called MyMixify, which is targeting children and is literally teaching children with a life-size Jenga game that they can balance drinks in the Jenga game with exercise in the Jenga game. There's a curriculum that's produced in part by Coca-Cola and the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation called Energy Balance 101, pushing this very same message. It's in over 50% of elementary schools in the United States now. We are letting Coca-Cola and the food industry into our doors. We're letting them into our schools. This is worrisome, and it does smack of what tobacco was doing 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Worrisome is one thing, but is it a cause of obesity in your view, Yoni Friedhoff?
Well, there's no question that sugar-sweetened beverages, as the single sole source provider of calories in North America, yes, you know, the single source provider of calories will likely be a cause of obesity.
And that doesn't require a whole lot of science as much as it just requires some math.
Yeah, I mean, again, there are a lot of issues that have led to the state we're in regard to obesity. There is no one cause. You can't simply say it's just Coca-Cola, but, you know, no one raindrop thinks it's responsible for the flood. Sugar-sweetened beverages are a hell of a big raindrop in this particular flood.
Yoni Friedhoff is director of the Bariatric
Soft
Medical
drink news flash
in Ottawa, Canada,
today,
and author of the Diet Fix. Thanks so much, Yoni.
Drink domain. Maple syrup water competes with coconut water at about half the calories and $5 a pint.
That's all for today, but if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. It's very healthy. You can find us on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. Take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news, and it reduces obesity. No, it doesn't. Actually, it hasn't been proven anyway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years. With services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From LegalZoom, for over 10 years working to help Americans navigate the legal system. With assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.